I'm going to do something I rarely, not ever did. And that is, I'm going to read. So you have to pay attention. I'm going to read from three tshuvas. Not really. I'm reading from two tshuvas in English, and one thing, something different from the Eichmann trial, the Nazi Machshavah, the trial in Israel, which will be at the end. I think this reading sometimes is a little on the boring side, but sometimes there's a lot of power in words. There are a few volumes of tshuvas from Holocaust. Very interesting questions in Holocaust. And there are a few tshuvas about tefillah. And I hope this is the last time that I have to stand up here and talk about a chizkat tefillah instead of talking about a nyanei tefillah, the concepts. It was as follows, that known in the ghettos, I'm not talking about the concentration camps, but in the ghettos, so with decrees, after decree, abolishing public prayer, which is tefillah b'tzibur. And when they abolished it, obviously if a person was to publicly daven, so he would be killed on the spot. Comes a question in August of 1942. So, when the Germans issued a decree forbidding all Jews in the ghetto to gather in synagogues or study halls, now what happened? Just hear clearly. This is part of the question. It's translated. It says, the broken-hearted residents, their bodies bent and racked from long days of slave labor. And you have to know what slave labor in the camps were during the Holocaust. It means no food, starvation. You were whipped, you were threatened, and you worked all day without rest. My father told me that. So what happened after the long days in the slave labor camps? So what they would do was, they would go gather together and they would forget some of their sufferings. So they assembled in the synagogues at fixed hours for the study of Torah and for davening. And it says in the question, listening to the encouraging words of the rabbis who were enduring the same tortured labor instilled in them a drop of hope in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And what they did was, the Jews, they found like holes in the walls and they made minyanim over there. I believe in Warsaw, and the threat of death, there were 600 minyanim. Secret minyanim. And there are many, many, many articles written about how careful they were and how they protected themselves, how behind the Aron Kodesh, to have a hiding place, to have watchmen. So the question is that the rabbi of one of the shuls, who was killed at Kiddush Hashem, asked Rav Oshri that is he obligated to risk his life to pray with a minion? And is he compelled to risk his life for Liman HaTorah? Of course, he writes, Rav Oshri says, that this, the Lashon, he writes in English, translated, I did not have the heart to rule that every Jew should risk his life in order to study Torah, pray with a minion. Yeah. I'd like to rule that. I don't have the heart to rule, to risk your life, because if you were caught, you were dead. On the other hand, how could I forbid any anyone to risk his life. All Jews possess holy souls that originate at the highest level above, and according to the halacha, each individual must probe the degree of his personal love and awe of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to determine his level of service to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his right or duty to make sacrifices. That's an unbelievable psak. He's saying, I can't forbid anybody to take the chance to daven b'tzibur or to learn, because everyone has his birthright, his right to be able to daven, to be able to learn. And a person must investigate the degree of his avin yiras Hashem. Beyond any doubt, it says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will guide each person to act with sensitivity. And he says, as a whole, people continue to study Torah and to pray with the fellow Jews. This is just one of many tshuvas about it, and it just always touches my heart. How fast we are to give up tefillah b'tzibur, or limudat Torah. You know, when we're not in the time of tragedy, or when we're not forced to do it. And, you know, I always pray that we're not put to the test. That when we're going to force to a time, if we have to, under the knife, daven b'tzibur, and really increase our limudat Torah. But one thing you do see from here, not to be serious nefesh of Klal Yisrael, for limudat Torah and tefillah b'tzibur, but you see the necessity of the neshama for tefillah b'tzibur and for limudat Torah. Because that was the whole nusach of the question. It was the only common effect, the only thing meaningful for a person that was laboring in a slave labor camp all day and night, starving. I need something. I have to grasp to something in my life. Something significant, something meaningful. Not a novel, not idle conversation. They could have idle conversation at night. They could sit at night and throw, you know, a couple of jokes, stories, accomplishments. Yeah, they could have done that. They could have talked about things of the past, made stories of the future. There's so much they could have done at night to relax and to really focus on something else, off the pain. But thousands upon thousands upon thousands upon thousands of Jews realize that the only thing meaningful is tefillah b'tzibur and limud haTorah. It's the meshivas nafesh, it restores the soul to a calmness and to a purity. If that's not a lesson for everyone over here, then what is? Then, if you want to know what tshuva about tefillah b'tzibur, in the Kovno ghetto, so they fix places for the public prayers, for tefillah b'tzibur. And they knew that if the Germans come in and they catch them, they're killed on the spot. And there was a, what they call a base of medrash of Tiferes Bachur. You know, Tiferes Bachur obviously must have been a place where most Bachurim davened. And they built in one of the empty, abandoned buildings. They took a room, they found an unfinished building, and they cleaned it, they constructed a table, benches, shelves, they built their own Kodesh. They had a hiding place that they created in the back of their own Kodesh, and they installed electricity, and it was close to the ghetto gates. And the Germans used to go in to look for the youngsters, the youth, to obviously bring them into the slave labor. So what happens, they wanted to know, if some of the youngsters had to hide from the Germans in the middle of davening, and everyone just stopped davening, but they would hide constantly, and they were behind the Oren, and other people were in the room itself, was that a good minyan? Isn't that an amazing question to ask in the middle of a Holocaust? Could they mitzurf to the minyan? Well, could they not be mitzurf to the minyan? Of course, the psak is that if there are 10 people in this room, then people that can hear it outside this room can mitzurf to the minyan. If there are not 10 people, then there is no minyan. But these are tshuvas. This is what's concerning. This is what's bothering. This is on the mind of Bachrin. In the midst of the ghetto, are the Yetzir Tefillah B'Tzibur not Yetzir Tefillah B'Tzibur? How much more really demanding is it upon us to have that same question? You know, when we daven every day, are we really being Yetzir Tefillah B'Tzibur? Or are we not being Yetzir Tefillah B'Tzibur? Do we daven with B'Tzibur? Do we hear Chazaras HaShas? Do we pay attention? You know, there are certain times we all have to become serious about life. Chazal say, why were the Ovis, the Imas, Akaras, why were the Imas, why were our fourth parents, why were they married, why couldn't they give birth to children? Chazal say, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu mis'avel l'tfilos l'shel tzadikim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu yearns the tefillah of tzadikim, what we call it Klal Yisrael. So what does it happen? HaKadosh Baruch Hu sometimes puts us in a situation that forces us to daven, because we come to the realization of our need and what's important. They say, a wise person learns from the experiences of other people. A fool has to experience it first himself to know the truth. There are tragedies in Klal Yisrael, there are tragedies in this world. You know, there's almost not a house that doesn't have an illness to it. There's almost a house that doesn't have no house that doesn't have some type of trial, tribulation, some type of suffering. Call it physical, financial, spiritual, children, parents, cousins, someplace. There's not a house today in Klal Yisrael that doesn't need heavy doses of tefillah and rachmanis from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You know that. Either it's in the immediate home, it's in the broader home, it's by a friend's home, a relative's home. You know, it doesn't have to hit you, so to say, to hit home. And of course, you're also misavim tefilosham, so you saw. So sometimes it happens to a neighbor, or a relative, or a friend, again, be it financial, spiritual, or physical, makes a difference. Tomorrow him, and tomorrow you. And if this iris doesn't come from afar, this iris will come from near, from close. And you don't want to come too close till it hits the person. Because when it hits the person, of course, then right away you're a mispala. You know, a person, Lo Aleinu, who is ill, very ill, made mention to me a thought that he had. And he said it was an awakening thought, too bitter, it was too late. And he could all think this through. He said when he was in, you know, basic nesses or yeshiva, and there was saying Tehillim for a chayla, he ran out like everybody else. He never listened to the Mishnah Berurah. He said it fast. He didn't say it without kavana. You know, when they were davening for Klal Yisrael, for Eretz Yisrael, for situations in the world, you know, Didn't hit him. It really didn't. He davened, you know. Maybe he sent it to him, maybe he didn't. But he's never really part of it. And he heard many times, Divrei Cyrus, you have to be part of it, you have to feel Tzolos and Shal Yisrael. You have to feel the tragedies, the hardships of Klal Yisrael. It's one family. But he never did. Right? So he did it. Until it hit him. And when the tragedy hit him at home, and it was a dual tragedy, he was ill, and a close member was killed in Eretz Yisrael. So he hit it on two sides. And he said he heard the lesson, he heard the echo. And he started davening very well. He said, you know what bothered him more than anything else? At that point he couldn't understand all the people that were running out of the hill. Where are they? Why am I alone davening? Why aren't you helping me, my davening? And he realized he's just as guilty then as his friends are today. Now it's too late. A fool learns from his own experiences. Has to wait till it hits him in the face. Then he learns, sometimes. A wise person learns from the experiences of other people. Both people that are close and people that are far. But what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu want? Let's go back to the point. He wants Tfilas and Shal Yisrael. As we mentioned many times, Tfilah is the relationship that we have with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we've mentioned many times, there's not one Tfilah in this world that goes unanswered. Sometimes it takes a few Tfilahs to be answered. Yeah? It says by Rivkin Yitzchok, it was 516. By Maisha, it's 516. It can take a lot of tefillahs, but there's no tefillah that doesn't go unheard or unprocessed. And there's not one tefillah that doesn't make a reisha. There are a lot of tefillahs you had that you didn't got them. That much I can tell you. And I think therefore, it's about time, it's really, that a person not just has inspiration, but makes the commitment. The happy thing is every time you have inspiration, you walk out and you don't make a commitment, it's meaningless. But if you know it's right, I think it's about time, hopefully it's the last time we ever speak about tefillah, in terms of inspiration. It's about time a person makes that commitment and finished. That he never misses a tefillah b'tzivah, and he has kavanah. Pure kavanah. If you use the article, use the tzuda, use whatever it is, just pure kavanah. He's sitting between your brother and he's answering you, and he's listening to you, he's listening to you. By the way, when you speak to me, the odds are I space out, I don't listen. When you speak to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I don't know. You don't bore him. He loves your words. He listens. Unfortunately, when you speak to me, you probably have much more kavana, concentration of what you're saying than when you speak to the Baruch Hu. It needs a direction. It needs a yeshiva das sitting in a place. It needs to be in a timely fashion, in an orderly fashion, an ordered mind, an ordered body. The order, time, a structure to it. And tefillah needs to be out loud. That comes from the kol, with a ruach, with a life, with a spirit to it. Yeah, there was what's tefillah? Put that aside now. There was a documentary many years ago. In my youth, I saw it. It was called The 50th blow. 5-0, the 50th blow. What was it? In the streets of Eretz Yisrael,
In the 1940s, 48, after the war, there was a young Jew, maybe your age, that was walking the streets, and he had not just bruises, but he had all types of blemishes, warts, you know, coming out from his face, from his back. He was limping. He was disformed. And people looked at him like, well, what is he? Who is he? You know, why do you have all these, I guess, you know, pains, or why do you have all these blemishes, call it right now, on you? Boils, that was the word I was looking for. Why are the boils on your back? Why isn't your back smooth? Why on your hands? What happened to you? And he said he was a survivor from the Holocaust. And in the Holocaust, the Germans, the Machshavim, they whipped him. You know, they're doing things, whatever it was, but they whipped him with a stick. And it had an everlasting impression upon him, obviously. He had the boils, he has the warts, he has the bruises, he limps, he's in pain, he's disformed. And why, they ask him? Because I was Jewish. The only reason why they whipped me was because I was Jewish. They used a wooden stick. How many times? 49 times. Beis Din, when they give Malchus, they gave 39. 40 minus 1. Very rare that they give the 39. Just think about it. Taking a whip on your back, or any part of you, 39 times. The Nazis in Machshavim did it to him 49 times without any rachmanis. And it had everlasting, it maimed him everlasting. And he said, this is in the documentary, he says, and what did the people in Eretz Yisrael respond? Oh, you know, life goes on. Wonderful. I suffered for being a Jew, I'm maimed, and they're apathetic. He says that's the 50th blow. That's why it's called the 50th blow. The blow of the apathy, of the not caring, of the not concern, of the coldness of the fellow Jews, the 50th blow was worse than all 49 blows of the Nazis in Machshavim. You know, when you're dealing with Shel Rasan Shel Yisrael, and we live in turbulent times, you can close your eyes from today to tomorrow. We live in turbulent times. And because we live in turbulent times, you know, one of the biggest challenges of today is people try to blind themselves from the pain of the world. The more you know people are, call alcohol, regular smoking, or just spaced out, or not accomplishing, they're hiding from pain. Pain, their pain, the world pain, the fear, whatever it is in the world, you know we live in turbulent times. The worst response to turbulence is apathy, not caring. That's not the Jewish response. That's the 50th blow. And that hurts more. Sometimes you see, even in yeshiva, you know, in by chaverim, when one person has a challenge, an obstacle, yeah, and people just turn their back to it. They ignore it. They don't take the step forward to help the person, to care for the person, to do something magnificent for the person, in front of them, behind them, whatever it is. That's a 50th blow. I don't care for my fellow Jew. And that's not true just amongst chaverim, but it's true even amongst outside. You know, reaching out to other people. I don't mean kiruv in that sense, but reaching out to other people. That's a 50th blow. You know what the biggest 50th blow is? You don't care about yourself. really pains. So apathetic that I know I'm not really accomplishing, going where I should be, doing what I should be doing. I know I'm not ready for my future, I'm not set for my future. I know that now is the time I have to determine my future. And I'm really not doing it. And I give up and I don't care. Apathy. The 50th blow. That's worse than any blow that anyone's going to hit on you. In the, I believe, in some of the, what they call the Sfarim HaKadoshim, on Tefillah, they teach up. Re'ei na v'anyenu. See our affliction. See, please, see now. Re'ei, see na v'anyenu. In our afflictions. V'riva rivenu. And they say, what's v'anyenu? In our afflictions, the afflictions that we put upon ourselves. Saying, listen carefully, just think of that in Yishmael Esrei. See our afflictions, the afflictions that I afflicted upon my body, the afflictions that I afflicted upon my soul, the afflictions that I put upon my personality. We are our worst enemy. We do the 49 blows. What anybody in this world will ever do to you will never be a fraction as big as what you did to yourself throughout your life. Any abuse, physical abuse, the odds are. Physical abuse that ever happened to you by an outside source is only a fraction of the physical abuse that you abuse yourself. Smokers know that. I can mug a smoker. I can beat up a smoker. I can put a smoker in the hospital and do a fraction of what he did to himself. See our afflictions that we did. Help me out. I'm my worst enemy. Say the Ruchnius. You know, take all the worst friends, the peers, the media, the world at large. Their influence that they did on me is a fraction of what I did to myself. They might be out there, I walked to them. They didn't really walk to me. I don't remember the last time I saw the media in a Beis HaMedrash. Or in a Jewish home. We brought it in. They didn't come in. They didn't break down the door. We brought the TV in. We brought the newspaper in. We opened our eyes. They did nothing. Re'ena v'anenu, our spiritual affliction. Our personality affliction is the same thing. How we really took our, we molded ourselves to the world where we did it. Re'ena v'anenu. The problem now is that the 49 blows that we did, and the worst blow is to come, the 50th blow, that we did it and we don't really care about it. And we're not taking the move, the full move, to change it, the commitment. I'll conclude with one other thing about a 50th blow. There was another 50th blow. And if you remember this, and I'm going to read it. If you remember this, the rest of your lives, every day, three times a day, I think you'll, this 50th blow will come in Machaper on the other 50 blows. On the Ein Nova Yeno, Kadosh Baruch Hu will see all the afflictions you place upon yourself, and he'll change you. He'll help you. This is from the Eichmann, a testimony from the Eichmann trial about what the Nazis did. And this person, his name was Mr. Kleinman, he testified as follows. Just listen to every word, it's so precious here. He said, one day I was lying on my cot in the children's hut. He's younger than you. In Auschwitz. And I saw the assistant commander of the hut walking with a thick rubber hose to beat someone. So the person says, I jumped up and ran to see whom they were going to beat. He writes, they were giving beatings for everything. And the number of blows was in accordance with the severity of the offense. On that day, the rubber hose came into use. Usually they would use a stick, which many times broke in the middle of the beating. And therefore they began to use a rubber hose. And I wanted to see how it worked. Imagine getting hit by a rubber hose. I might have to meet up with it myself someday, he writes, or he testified. The assistant commander of the hut went up to one of the cots. The boy there already knew and was waiting for him. Get down, the assistant commander told him. The boy bent over and they began to beat him. We, a group of young men who were standing around, watched, each one counting the blows individually. The boy didn't cry or yell. He didn't even sigh. We were very amazed. There had been many more than 25 blows. Usually they would give 25 blows. You wouldn't survive more than 25 blows. And now it was already more than 30. When the attacker passed 40 blows, where's we gonna hit him anymore? He turned the boy over and began to beat him on the legs and on the head. The boy didn't sigh, didn't cry, nothing. A boy of 14, and he didn't cry. The soldier got very angry, finished the 50 blows, and left him. We picked him up. I remember one large red mark that he had on his forehead from one of the smashes of the rubber hose. And he testifies. We asked him why they had beat him. And then he answered, it was worth it. It was worth it. They asked him, why did they beat him? Then he answered, it was worth it. I brought my friends a few sidurim, and they davened. He added nothing more. He got up, climbed into his cot, and sat there and said it was worth it. But Baisai, when we're talking about tefillah, and with all the rain of pains, all the afflictions that we afflicted in Klal Yisrael, family, friends, and the afflictions upon ourselves, of three words, if you always remember it, it was, four words, it was worth it. It's really worth it.